Hello and welcome to the UN Human Rights Podcast, Dignity, Freedom, and Justice for All, commemorating the 75th anniversary of the Universal Declaration of Human Rights. I'm Lisa Smith from UN Human Rights, one of the hosts for this season of stories. In this episode, we take a closer look at racial justice, what it means, and what more needs to be done to fight for it. And we're talking to some experts with a unique point of view on the subject, as well as one of the biggest names in civil rights law in the USA, Benjamin Crump. Stay tuned. Seventy-five years ago, Article 2 of the Declaration affirmed the equal enjoyment for all human rights without distinction of any kind, including race and color. Yet today, racism, often rooted in legacies of enslavement and colonialism, continues to affect the human rights of countless people in its contemporary form. Today's episode of Dignity, Freedom, and Justice for All takes a closer look at the concept of racial justice with two discussions with experts who have unique views on the subject. First in discussion are two experts on both racial justice and human rights. Dominique Day is a member of the Working Group on People of African Descent. She's also a human rights attorney. Tracy Kazi is a member of the Expert Mechanism to Advance Racial Justice and Equality in the Context of Law Enforcement in All Parts of the World. She's a former police officer, having served 25 years on the Denver Police Force. They were first asked how they would each define racial justice. Dominique Day answers first. They're interviewed by Kaloy Henry from UN Human Rights.
I think racial justice, it's not a target, it's a process. Racial injustice is woven into the very fabric of our economy, of our society in every space. And so racial justice is the process of unweaving that, is the process of unlocking these commitments to racial hierarchy that sort of exist even without actively promoting them and really giving people the opportunity to live inside their dreams.
I love what Dominique said. And I think that it's a question that I struggle with. And I struggle with it because in the work, it means so many different things to different people. I agree that it's definitely interwoven in everything that we do. But I struggle because so many people have defined it in so many different ways that it makes it so difficult to put a pin on it. I agree. I think that it is something that we all need to make sure that we sort of disentangle it from the systems in which define who we are and how we operate. But it also defines who we are in a way in which if we don't define it, it renders us invisible. And I think that the struggle is the justice side of it for me. And what does that look like? And what does it mean? And how does that feel? And how do you make that right for millions of people? Not just present day, historically, and moving forward.
Okay, so let's say you have a wish, and within that wish, you basically, you know, racial justice is achieved. What would things look like? What would things look like on the ground? What would the world look like?
So I think what it would look like, and I look at it, I'm old now, so I look at it through the eyes of my grandson who's 12, and I look at it in a way in which he can show up in spaces, and he can feel safe. For one, two, he can be in a space where he is fully recognized as who he is, and he's appreciated for that. He's not defending it and having to define it, but he's accepted in his whole person. He's also appreciated in his whole person. And, you know, as a young Black male, that is something that is neither stigmatized nor tied, hopefully, to the stigmas of the past. And I think it's done in a way in which at some point in his world, he doesn't have to think about that, that he moves effortlessly and safely. And I think that that is something that I wish not just for him, but for everybody, and especially my granddaughter, that she owns her body and that she owns it in a way, again, that is effortlessly, that she doesn't have to defend and protect, that she doesn't have to label from her hair to her toes.
A lot of our systems focus on mitigating the extremes of racial injustice. So people being killed by the police, people being prevented from going to school, people being prevented from spending time with their families. But even if you take care of all of those extreme forms of racial violence and racial atrocity, there's the everyday racism that I experience walking through the world that impacts my joy. Maybe another concrete example is, you know, I live in Oakland now, and we had a Black Joy Parade, but it's amazing. People come out and bring their joy, and there's kids who come out and do tricks on bicycles, and there's Black cowboys who come out with their horses and like dazzle you. And there's all these Black men who drive Corvettes, and there's all the Greek organizations coming out doing their stepping. And the parade is filled with a diverse vision of Black joy that is so real and so free and yet so unusual, not just the parade, but each piece of it. And so in these spaces, right, when we ask about like, what would it look like? It would look like, you know, maybe it would look like Wakanda, right? It would look like something that really allowed people's inner joy to be reflected in their everyday, rather than what we see for a lot of Black folk around the world, where their inner joy is only safe in, maybe not even in their home, but their public persona has to reflect a constant checking for elements of unsafety that may come from public servants themselves.
And the energy is so different, right? A joy of parade is so different. And we get so locked into, as you mentioned, sort of defending the moment, that we forget that we do have joy, because we often forget. We get so slogged down in trying to find justice for those who deserve it, so much so that we often forget that we are joyous people.
You know, as somebody who's worked in law enforcement and somebody who has been an activist within the community, what do human rights experts need to understand about policing so that the both worlds understand each other?
So, you know, the expert mechanism that I was appointed to, along with Professor Juan Mendez and Justice Yvonne Mukuru, we call it IMLAR, but it's the Expert Mechanism to Advance Racial Justice and Equity in the Context of Law Enforcement, right after George Floyd. And what is interesting, and I think what people in the field should often know, are the folks that decide to go into those particular careers or professions often are doing so under a couple of different guises. One, there is a belief that they are providing public safety, that they are doing a service. And so I think what most human rights folks on the ground often need to understand is that when you put people into bad systems, you often can't correct them. And you have to do more than just continue to push more people into systems. And oftentimes the cultures of those places will take control of people, and you will find that you will lose because culture is very powerful. And so you're going to have to make sure that you're not only talking about the same thing, but how you're defining it and who gets to define it. And in doing that work, then you can begin to figure out what are the steps that need to happen. You're going to, in a sense, have to center those folks who are not just helping you define what it means for them to be safe, but what are the other component pieces to that? And oftentimes law enforcement doesn't understand. They have been asked to do a lot of things that they shouldn't be doing. The most probably recent things that we talk about are mental health, right? And I can tell you, when I was in police department 30 years ago, I was not trained on mental health. And the conversations I have, whether it's with law enforcement or whether it's with communities, and even whether it's with activists, everybody wants the same thing. They want to move safely. They want to exist safely. And most of all, they just want to be.
What do you think the biggest challenges that we're facing right now in the quest for racial justice globally?
Well, I think people get really invested in seeing themselves as righteous actors wherever they are. And so their complicity with racial injustice, racial hierarchy, and racial atrocity either gets justified, denied, or erased. And so to me, that's number one, sort of the perception of righteousness and just mindset. But Tracy.
No, I'm going to plus one on that. I would also say that probably the number one piece of this is the lack of reckoning with our historical perspectives here. I think that, you know, the righteous actors is correct, but it is the absolute lack of acknowledgement of how we got here and that this somehow just sprung up. And I think that
the inability to accept the fact that this is never been dealt with, and that history has continued to keep repeating itself because we won't acknowledge it. And then in addition to, I would say, the fact that this is a social construct that was created that can also be dismantled. And that is the biggest thing for me right now, those two things. And there is no will, because the power and the supremacy of that power benefits one group, absolutely, without any question. And that is the way that folks want it to be.
You have people's grandparents were colonized or were in Africa raping and looting, but who see themselves as custodians of a legacy of empire, even as they talk about dismantling racial hierarchy. So you have this real issue where our ideas of family, tradition, and history, we've sanitized them. Some people have sanitized them such that truth has become a threat rather than a mode of reconciliation.
Yes, it's not only a threat, but you also have to explain it to generations of your children and grandchildren. And there is, as you mentioned, it's not only just being a custodian, you have to emotionally deal with the fact of what has happened here. And I think we have millions of people who cannot emotionally handle what has happened, because you have to, in order to feel it, then you can deal with it. And I think that is
in order
the
to deal
piece
with
right
it,
here.
You need to feel it. I like that.
That's correct.
That, you that's do. What I might have to put that on a t-shirt. Okay, last question for both of you. As you know, we're commemorating 75 years of the Declaration. It basically, it's got 30 articles where like 30 human rights have been codified. It's 7 decades later. What does it look like right now for, you know, rights relating to racial justice? And what can we do? But what can individuals, people who might be listening to this podcast, people who might sort of see something about it, what can individuals do to basically move the needle on racial justice?
What we can do is start looking at how racism shows up in our local spaces, in our intimate spaces, in our communities, thinking about how to dismantle that, and then think about how we can demand for support from the international human rights structure, from litigation, from politicians, from community support. It needs to be things that we can see, and we need to articulate it in ways that allow the racial atrocity and injustice to be visible.
So for me, just on the same as Dominique, educate and open your mouth and intervene, because you do see it. Everyone does see it. And in the spaces that I have been in with people and sat with people, what they have said to me is they've been afraid to speak up. Speak up, educate, speak up, because that is how we have the conversations that we have. I'm not looking for you to take the blame. I'm looking for you to educate yourselves and speak up. The ability to change the way the interactions and the alternatives to public safety happen is local. So educate yourself. Don't listen to what everyone else is telling you without doing your own research yourself beyond what you do every day. Don't just fall into groupthink, and don't just do things that confirm what you already believe you know. Go beyond that. Educate yourself and call it out.
Thanks, Dominique and Tracy, for a lively and enlightening discussion. Staying on topic of racial justice, we get a view from the front lines of the fight. Benjamin Crump is a U.S.-based attorney whose work has had him advocating for some of the biggest cases of racial injustice in that country. Trayvon Martin, lead poisoning in Flint, Michigan. George Floyd, whose death kicked off global protests against police brutality and racism. But for an advocate like Ben, what does racial justice look like? He's interviewed by Kayloy Henry.
You know, the short answer is it is equal rights for everybody wherever they exist. That is what racial justice is. In America, we have the rhetoric of liberty and justice for all. Well, if we're to talk about racial justice, we have to make that rhetoric reality, not just for white people, but also for Black and brown people and marginalized people of color. We have to make sure that all of our children have an equal opportunity. And I think that should be real for every human being around the globe.
So what do you, what do you see are the biggest obstacles, the biggest challenges facing achieving racial justice for every human being around the globe?
I think it is implicit bias, racism, and discrimination. It is the institutions that exist. You know, people will come and go, but the institutions live beyond our lives. And as I have often articulated, that racism and discrimination is so ingrained in American society that when you protest against racism and discrimination, people believe that you're protesting against America.
75 years ago, the Universal Declaration of Human Rights was ratified, and it codified the basic human rights that we all are born with. 7 decades on, what do you see as a state of racial justice right now? Has anything improved?
We have made progress, and so I remain optimistic that we will make a better world for our children, all of our children. But we can never be complacent. Every day we have to get up understanding that we have to fight for equal justice under the law. And I understand that everybody won't be a civil rights lawyer, won't be on the front lines, but we all have a role to play. Whether you're in the corporate sector, the educational sector, the governmental sector, we all have a role to play, and we all have to live up to the role to make the world better. And, you know, Frederick Douglass said that we have to understand without struggle, there can be no progress. And so we have to celebrate the struggle, because that means we're making progress. And so we have to embrace the struggle for our children's future, for our community's future, for our culture's future. We have to say, no, we're going to strike a match rather than curse the darkness. Every day we wake up, and I don't care about the statistics. I don't care about the obstacles. I don't care what they say are the daunting realities. We know, based on precedent in the world, that we will overcome whatever the enemies of equality have to throw at us. We can never, ever believe that the enemies of equality will win this war. No, it will be the moral people who win this war. The people of good character will win this war.
George Floyd, as we mentioned before, his death garnered huge attention globally. It even caused us here in Geneva with the Human Rights Council to create something called the Expert Mechanism to Advance Racial Justice and Equality in Law Enforcement. And the idea here was to advance racial justice and equality in the context of law enforcement in all parts of the world. Did you see this case making this great of an impact? And how have you seen those impacts result in the work that you do? Has it given you a more global perspective?
It has given me a global perspective. The fact that it wasn't just people marching in the U.S. when George Floyd was tortured to death by the people who were supposed to protect and serve him. It was people marching in Europe, people marching in South America, people marching in China, people marching in Russia, people marching everywhere. We got so many messages on social media, so many people emailing and calling my office saying, until we get justice for George Floyd, none of us can breathe. And I just thought that was so profound.
You are granted a wish, and the world now has equity, equality, and racial justice. What does that look like to you?
That my children and your children can grow up in a world where they're given an equal opportunity to live out the fulfillment of their destiny that God has for them without them being taken from this earth in an unjustified, inhumane manner, a world where they're not bound by racism, but they're bound by justice and equality. That is the hope. That is the prayer.
Two last questions for you. The first question I want to ask you is about human rights. Do you consider yourself a human rights defender?
I do. I believe that, in essence, civil rights, you contemplate that you have a right to make sure, because you are an American citizen, you have these civil rights. But I think it's more profound than that. I think we have these rights because we are human beings. I think about Malcolm X saying, we declare our right to exist on this earth at this time, in this space, by any means necessary. And we have to say human beings have a right to be able to be free of oppression, no matter what fashion, form, or manner that it comes in.
And final question for you. You talked about, you know, what a world that has achieved racial justice and equity and equality would look like. What can people do? What can individuals do to help achieve this, to move the needle forward on the idea of racial justice?
I think two things. I think number one, we can't wait and be reactive. We got to try to get to the source before our children are caught up in a system that will have them crippled for life. And so we have to be proactive. We have to be strategic. We have to understand that the game is chess, not checkers. We have to be strategic if we're going to win this war. And finally, I say this, what we have to do, if we really want to make a difference in this world and giving our children a better world, is making sure that they are well armed to protest that vote when the enemies of equality are deciding to have them on the menu for lunch. That is what we got to fight for. And I guess essentially what I'm saying is this. The only way we win this war for justice and equality is to make sure that our children are more intelligent than those who will seek to oppress them.
Yes to that. I want to thank Ben for taking the time to share his unique insight from the front lines of the battle for racial justice. Well, we've come to the end of this episode of Dignity, Freedom, and Justice for All, commemorating 75 years of the Universal Declaration of Human Rights. Join us next time, where our High Commissioner, Volker Türk, will take a deep dive into what it means to have a human rights-enhancing economy. If you want to join in on the commemorations or are interested in learning more about the Declaration and the 75th Anniversary Campaign, then please go to our website, www.ohchr.org/get-involved. I'm Lisa Smith, and thanks for listening.